and welcome. Sean Delaney here with this week's Inside Education, the podcast for educators interested in teaching. You can listen back to or download hundreds of podcasts of Inside Education on seandelaney.com/podcasts. You can contact me by writing to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. The Twitter handle is @InsideEd. My guest on the program this week is Ian Mentor, Professor Emeritus at Oxford University. Having started his career as a primary teacher, Ian Mentor became interested in teacher education, in teachers' work, and in education policy. He is a former president of the British Education Research Association. He was a member of a research group who conducted an examination of teacher education policy in five nations, the Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England, which led to the publication of Teacher Education in Times of Change. When I met up with Ian Mentor at the focal meeting of the World Education Research Association, which was held in Tokyo in August 2019, we covered several topics. We discussed how teacher education in England differs from teacher education in its nearest neighbours. We went on to talk about teachers as researchers and roles in schools as research leads. We look ahead to the future of teacher education, and Ian tells me about how he became a teacher educator. I began our conversation, though, by noting that Ian Mentor had conducted research on teacher education policy across Northern Ireland, England, Scotland and Wales. I then asked him what similarities and differences he found across those nations.
Well, I've been part of a five-nation group, actually, that included the Republic of Ireland as well as Northern Ireland. And we had people from each of those five jurisdictions working together to over 2 or 3 years, and resulted in a book called Teacher Education in Times of Change. And our group was called the Teacher Education Group. And we found a considerable amount of variety around the five nations, but the kind of simple conclusion is that when you step back and look at the five nations, it's England, the largest of those five nations, that is the kind of outlier, really. It's more different from the others than the others are from each other, if you see what I mean. And in particular, you know, it's diverged over the last few years as the various governments in Westminster have sought to exert influence over teacher education policy, and of course most recently since 2010 to actually, to some extent, marginalise the contribution of higher education to teacher education. That hasn't happened to anything like that extent in any of the other four nations. Indeed, in the Republic, for example, or in Scotland as well, in a way the role of universities and higher education has been strengthened over that same period rather than weakened. And I'm afraid we did come to the conclusion that it's a kind of ideological antipathy that certain politicians have got towards education departments in universities. Michael Gove, the Secretary of State in 2010, referred to the academic blob when he was disparaging university departments of education, and his move for school-based and school-led teacher education was very much a concern to make teacher education, or teacher training as he would call it, very much on the job, school based, and he really doubted the contribution that theoretical study or indeed educational research can make in teacher education. So England kind of stands out in that respect. There are similar things going on in other parts of the world, such as the USA and to a lesser extent in Australia. But in the four other jurisdictions around the Isles of Britain, you can see a very concerted attempt to build theory and practice together, to build the links between schools and universities, and to have a kind of integrated approach to teacher education.
And if we stick with the outlier for the moment, and England being the outlier, what is it that made it so vulnerable to political interference, if you like, or political influence, to be more neutral?
Yeah, part of what I think we argue in that book is that those of us working in higher education should have been more active in promoting what we saw as the value of the university or higher education contribution. Indeed, the study that I was involved in that BERA, the British Educational Research Association, undertook with the Royal Society for the Arts, the report was published in 2014 on research and the teaching profession. That was really set up because of the lack of positive response to government intervention in English teacher education, although that study, that report did cover all four nations of the United Kingdom. And it was really an attempt to go back to basics and just try and actually demonstrate whether higher education actually made a contribution, and if so, what that contribution was. So, you know, there have been lots of organisations in teacher education, but they haven't had the political influence that was required to resist those kind of interventions, what in other work I've called the tightening grip of Whitehall on teacher education. It became increasingly ideological, really from the 1980s onwards, and there was never any concerted attempt to challenge that in a kind of rational way, and that's why we set up the BERA inquiry, and it has had a bit of influence, I'm glad to say.
And is it because the response has been quite fragmented from the university sector?
I think so, and I mean, I'm afraid to say, but maybe education departments in universities are not the strongest departments often in the senior management's eyes. Some people have called them the Cinderella of the university sector and struggling to get a central position. In the US, David Labrie talked about the trouble with ed schools, which is a similar kind of concern that really schools of education in US universities have had relatively low status. In England, we have even seen two or three universities closed down teacher training because they felt variously that it was unstable because of government policy, or that the concentration on training teachers took academics' attention away from the research activity, and they were worried about the results in the research assessments over the years. So two or three universities actually closed down. But yes, I think there was a kind of fragmentation, but also a question of standing and status within the academy. Having said that, actually, educational research, which does underpin a lot of teacher education, did extremely well in the last research excellence framework exercise in 2014, and was in the social sciences, was one of the strongest areas of research.
If we leave the outlier then for the moment, yeah, and go to the other, to Wales, Scotland, yeah, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, what were the characteristics of teacher education in those nations?
Well, the one thing that everybody has experienced is a process of review and reform. Every one of those nations had at least one major report. In Northern Ireland, it goes into the 20s, I think. They've had more than 20 reports over the last 10 or 15 years on teacher education. And in Republic of Ireland, Pasi Sahlberg led a team that called for major reorganisation. But many of those reports, particularly the Irish, both of the Irish ones, north and south of the border, have been more concerned with the structure of provision, the location of provision, than with the actual processes of teacher education. In Wales and Scotland, there's been some interest in provision. Certainly in Wales, they've regrouped and then reshaped under the in response to reports from John Furlong. But there and in Scotland, the real interest has been on trying to ensure that there is an integrated approach to teacher education, that theory and practice are combined in the processes, and that teacher education is underpinned by high quality research. In Republic of Ireland, I'm jumping around a bit here, but in the Republic, I've had some involvement with what's known as NICE, N-I-S-E, the National Institute for Studies in Education, which is the result of a collaboration between the institutions in Limerick. And I'm on a board there to help advise them develop their activity. But there, as a result of the Saalberg report, they have established this close collaboration between the three teacher education institutions based in Limerick, and are really working hard to ensure that research and teacher education are very closely integrated. And I think that's happening in other parts of the Republic. You would probably know more about that than me, but certainly I'm impressed by what is being undertaken there. So I can be pretty positive about what's happening in the Republic, what's happening in Scotland, what's now happening in Wales. Northern Ireland continues to be problematic, mainly because of the well-known kind of tensions within the community there and the sectarian elements of provision, which have in some senses led to a kind of inertia in the whole system where, I mean, some good practice going on, but they can't actually kind of really respond to the advice they were given by their report, which John Furlong was also involved in that one. But there's good practice going on in Northern Ireland, as in the other jurisdictions. I'd even say there's good practice going on in England, and some of the school-based initiatives that have resulted from Michael Gove's edicts have actually turned out to be quite successful, where the providers, the schools, are continuing to work closely with higher education. We've also had Teach First in England, which, I mean, I'm going back to the outlier, because Teach First hasn't really operated anywhere else in these islands, but it has had some influence in England because it's a school-based approach originally designed to attract graduates from the best universities to work in the most challenging schools, and it puts people in a training post for 1 year and then in an employment post for the second year, and then after that they're free to go to their longer term career, which might be in something completely different, such as banking or law even. But the effect of bringing those people in and having that intensive program of preparation, I think, has influenced other providers to think about how they recruit, how they prepare people to work in schools in challenging circumstances. So there's a lot of good things happened in spite of what has felt like a very unstable period in teacher ed in England.
And apart from its influence on other providers, how successful is Teach First perceived to be?
Well, it depends to some extent on who you ask, but there are some very good teachers who've come into the profession through Teach First. I believe the figures are still about 50% of them leaving after they've done their 2 year stint. So there is a question about value for money there, even if the teachers are good while they're there. It costs quite a lot to put people through Teach First as an employment-based route. So there are good people coming in, but we're also losing some. So I think the jury's really out long-term. What has never been in any doubt is the political backing for Teach First. There's, again, a very strong ideological driver behind it because of its close connection with the private sector and with as a not-for-profit organisation. It's got presses all the right buttons politically, but it did have sort of pretty ideological origins, and it seems to be established now in the English scene, and has made attempts to get into Scotland so far as I'm aware, not successfully. There was a small Teach First element in Wales, which I think currently is not operating, but in England it is pretty well established now.
Because one of the problems that Teach for America has had is that it led to teachers who entered that route burning out very quickly,
yeah,
because they had to work a lot harder,
yeah,
in order, because, well, they didn't have the preparation.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there have been people in the English Teach First who've experienced that, but let's not forget that many teachers are burning out across the profession, particularly in England, but also in other parts of the UK. Teaching has become an intensified profession, and we know the retention figures are really quite challenging in England, and even in parts of Scotland they're becoming a bit worried about hanging on to teachers. So burnout is a real issue for the teaching profession generally, and maybe, yes, Teach First is one place where you may expect to see that happening, but given that they get very strong, very committed people in, there's probably, I don't know, I haven't looked at the figures, but I'd be surprised if there was really a higher rate of burnout in Teach First than there is in mainstream or other forms of provision in England, certainly.
To what extent is teaching in primary or secondary education, to what extent is that evidence-based?
The English Department for Education had a period about 5 years ago when they actually used the phrase EBT, evidence-based teaching, promoting the idea of evidence-based teaching. And we have seen some real moves towards that, both coming from the top, but also coming up from the ground. From the ground, we've seen organisations that have supported teacher research and encouraged teach meets as a kind of way of encouraging teachers to share their experience, sometimes on the basis of research, certainly on the basis of some form of evidence. Coming from the top down, we've seen the Education Endowment Foundation in England carrying out largely randomised controlled trials, which are designed to lead to identifying, quote, what works, unquote, in teaching. And there have been some successes there, but probably not as many as the funders and organisers would have hoped. But I think one of the most positive developments, still early days, but one of the most positive developments is the Chartered College of Teaching in England, which has moved into the space that is occupied by teaching councils or their equivalent in other parts, including in the Republic. So the Chartered College of Teaching is certainly trying to encourage the profession to develop as an evidence-based profession. Alison Peacock, who's the chief executive of the college, is very committed to evidence-based teaching, and their journal that goes into schools is full of reports of research. So I do think there's some real moves in the right direction, and I think the more that the higher education section, particularly education departments in universities, can align themselves with those developments, the more effective everything will be. In fact, when we did the BEERA report, what we called for there in the end was recognition of the importance of what we called research literacy. So teachers really understanding how research is done, perhaps having some skills in inquiry themselves, but not that they could become full-time researchers at the same time as being teachers, but they should become more aware of research and the contribution it could make. And there's a zeitgeist around where those kinds of ideas are much better received than they were 10 or 15 years ago.
And how would you see that working out in practice? How would teachers become more research literate?
Well, it would need to be through the education programmes that they receive themselves. I mean, of course, in that our report, we were thinking very much about how research literacy can be integrated into the initial teacher education programmes. But then there would need to be further provision for continuing professional development that was evidence-based, inquiry-oriented. And in a lot of schools now, we're actually seeing the identification of kind of research leads amongst the teaching staff. So somebody on the staff who kind of overviews what's going on in the school in terms of research and development, and somebody who maybe is looking outside the school to find relevant research to bring in and to liaise with actual full-time researchers, perhaps working in universities. So there is a general sort of shift in the culture of teaching, I think, to really bring research closer into the profession. It's amazing, really, to me how long it's taken for that to really start happening. I mean, Lawrence Stenhouse was writing in 1975 about the teacher as researcher. The ideas of John Dewey, which date back to the beginning of the 20th century, were imbued with the idea that teachers should at least be reflective and probably be capable of some inquiry. So it has taken rather a long time.
But there's probably a need as well for education researchers to write for teachers rather than writing for each other.
Well, yes, that has been one of the criticisms that has been levelled over the years at education researchers, that they write papers that get published in journals that sit on shelves and gather dust and or maybe peer-reviewed by other academics. But I think there is a much greater range of publication now, and the example I gave earlier of the Chartered College having a publication itself, which many academics contribute to that and write for a teacher audience, teacher readership. And I think there's greater awareness on part of academics that they must communicate with the professional community that their work is supposed to serve.
And what kind of research then does policy and practice need?
What it needs may be different from what is actually used. One of the things I'm going to be referring to in my paper on English teacher education later this afternoon is about how some of the research seems to be misused, if not abused, by policymakers in England. But what, to answer your question directly, I think we do need to have, in teacher education, we need to understand better how the processes of teacher learning actually happen. We need longitudinal work that really follows teachers through from their pre-service teacher education into their careers, so that we can see what influences them in their practices. In terms of research to inform policy, I think we again need long-term work, but we need large-scale work as well. There's been very remarkably little large-scale work on teaching and teacher education. We need a lot of it to be independent. I mean, some of the work that has been done has been government-funded and has had quite narrow framing in the first place, so that you kind of almost know what's going to come out of it before it's started. But in the general terms, what we do want is research that can inquire into what seems to lead to effective teacher education and effective teaching. And politicians will support that idea, but hitherto they've not necessarily found the ways of encouraging the research to actually happen. That kind of research is seriously underfunded. The greatest funding at the moment in England goes to the Education Endowment Foundation, which are these kind of evaluations of the impact of classroom interventions by and large, and that's important work, but it shouldn't be the only kind of work that goes on, and it shouldn't be limited to randomised controlled trial work as well. Important though those may be, there are many other ways of finding out what is going to lead to desirable outcomes in classrooms and in teaching.
If you were to look into a crystal ball, I suppose, and to see how do you think teaching and teacher education will change in the next decade? Or, I mean, if that's too far, even in the next 5 years, what kind of trends do you discern that are going to shape the future of teaching and teacher education?
Well, I do feel we're living in quite unstable times politically. And, you know, we have a new education secretary, Secretary of State for Education in England, for yet another one. And I've lost count of how many changes there have been in the last 5 or 10 years. And so there's an element of instability in the policy context. But if we didn't have that instability, then I would like to see a shift towards closer links between the research community and the policy community and the practice community. I tend to see those as three communities that need to intersect and interact, and there are times and places where that happens and there are times and places where it doesn't happen. So if I wanted to be optimistic, I'd say let's be hopeful that those three communities will interact much more closely. In terms of how teaching itself will develop, I think there's all kinds of questions at the moment about curriculum, about assessment, about teaching methods that really need to be pursued in a systematic way. We have questions about, you know, we're discussing questions at this conference that we're at the moment about what education is actually for. Do we need schools to deliver the kind of educational outcomes we want? Might there be better ways of using digital technologies? Might there be better ways of organizing learning socially in communities? There's all kinds of things that could happen. At the moment, or for the last few years, we've tended to see a kind of great anxiety shaping policy, the anxiety of the PISA tests, the international league tables of educational achievement. Those have tended to shape how policymakers and politicians have shaped what teachers do. But if teachers do take more control of their own work through organisations such as the Chartered College or the teaching councils in the other jurisdictions, then I think there is a hope that if teachers can regain a kind of professional confidence and professional voice in collaboration with the research community, then and keep talking to the policy community, then we might see a more trusting kind of environment for professional practice. Many teachers feel they are not trusted by the community, and that's exacerbated by sections of the popular press and by statements by some politicians. So we do need to have trust in teachers. People come into teaching because, you know, they want to make a difference and they want to help young people develop into fully rounded citizens. And if we can get the conditions right for that, then I'm optimistic that we can see some significant developments over the next few years. And, you know, let's look back on this in 5 or 10 years' time and see which direction things have travelled.
We hear a lot, and indeed we've mentioned it even today in our discussion so far, about the idea of teacher as researcher.
Yeah.
How do you understand that term?
I see the teacher as researcher as being somebody who sees inquiry as an integral part of their practice. They are not just delivering a curriculum. They're not just wanting good exam results, important though those may be in practical terms. They are seeing their activity as an intellectual engagement with learners, a process of interaction between teacher and learner, which can be developed and improved and better understood by asking yourself as a teacher critical questions about what you're doing. I mean, it may be quite mundane things about the way you organise your classroom or the frequency with which you carry out formative assessment of children. Those things may be, you know, very routine, but if you look at them critically, you may be able to find ways of improving them and improving your understanding of what's going on. But they may also be more sort of deep-rooted fundamental ideas about why are we doing what we're doing? And talking to parents in the community, talking to other organisations in the community around the school can lead to some wider questions about the purposes of education. I mean, historically, you know, there have been three main purposes of education: an economic one, a kind of citizenship one, and a kind of cultural one. So the economic one is about preparing people for the workforce, the citizenship one about giving people the skills and qualities they need to be able to engage as a fully rounded citizen in their community and in the political system. And the kind of cultural one is really about understanding ideas, literature, sciences, the kind of history of learning, the history of knowledge, so that they have a sense of the meaning of the world around them and actually may be able to make a contribution to it in the future. So I think those three kind of fundamental purposes are still there and valid, and you know, the way in which they balance with each other, because there are different forces behind each of those three main aims, is really critical and central to the way in which education policy and practice develop in any society or community.
And is it extra work that a teacher has to do then if they're to reflect, or if they're to be a researcher as well? You know, I mean, in other words, I suppose I'm wondering, is it a distraction for teachers, a distraction from their real work, which is, you know, student development?
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to get a shift in how we define their real work. So it cannot be a distraction. It has to, if it's to work in the way that I would hope, it has to be integrated into practice, so it's not extra work. It may feel like that initially, and certainly when we were doing the BIRA report, lots of teachers said, but we cannot be researchers as well as teachers, just what you have implied to me. But if we get the balance right and get the support structures right, then it's not extra work. It's kind of a taken for granted element of what it is to be a good teacher, somebody who does inquire into their own practice and is not afraid to kind of challenge and question the policy context that they find themselves in. So I'm sure, you know, you're right to say it cannot be a huge extra burden on what teachers already undertake. It has to be effectively integrated into their day-to-day work.
Or what kind of support structures might make that more possible, do you think?
Well, the kinds of things I mentioned earlier, like having a research lead in a school, can be very valuable.
That's somebody with a specific responsibility for promoting research in the school?
Promoting research, bringing research findings into the school in a kind of digestible form. So that's an important thing. Some schools actually have research committees now, not many, but a few have set up research committees. In fact, when I was working in Scotland, we did a project from the University of Glasgow called Research to Support Schools of Ambition. Schools of Ambition is a rather unfortunate phrase, because one would hope all schools were ambitious, but these were schools that were designated. They had to apply for extra funding to undertake some particular development over a period of 2 years, and they were required to kind of research that development while they did it. And that actually led to, in some of those schools, to a real cultural transformation, because they'd been required to take research seriously, and they found it did actually change the approach to the in-school policies and practices. So those kinds of things can be very effective. And I do think liaison with higher education, I do think every school should take its links with higher education seriously, and have regular engagement with people. The kind of real resource for research skills is always going to be in universities and higher education. So we're not talking about every school becoming a kind of outstanding centre of educational research, but we can talk about schools becoming centres where educational research is undertaken in collaboration with universities. In Finland, they do have these university training schools, where indeed they are centres of research, and they are linked with the university, and there is a kind of what you'd call a research programme that is taking place within the school. And that seems to have been part of why Finnish schools have been pretty successful over recent years. And those kinds of things could be explored more systematically in England, I think.
And when you were thinking of the idea of teacher as researcher, is that similar to what Donald Shone talked about when he talked about reflection on action and inaction and for action?
Well, I'm going to refer to some of my own research to answer that question. When I was in Scotland, we undertook a literature review for Graham Donaldson, who himself was undertaking the review of initial teacher education. And we looked at hundreds of research reports, policy documents, etc. And we identified different models of teacher professionalism, as we called it. And this was a kind of spectrum that we put into our report to Graham Donaldson. And we talked about a spectrum moving from the model of the effective teacher through the reflective teacher to the inquiring teacher to the transformative teacher, a kind of four-point continuum or spectrum. The effective teacher is the one who does deliver the curriculum effectively and gets adequate or good exam results. The reflective teacher, which is the phrase that Donald Shearn and co use, not only is effective, but also ask questions about what they're doing, so is brings in an element of greater criticality. The inquiring teacher is the one who actually brings some research skills and inquiry methods into it. So it's more than reflection. Reflection can simply be, you know, what did I do? How can I learn from it? An inquiring teacher implies somebody who's undertaking something more systematic than that, using some kind of research design, if that's not too grand a word. And then the transformative teacher is the one who does all of the foregoing, but also sees a kind of wider purpose to their work in terms of either bringing about change in their community, transforming the community that they're working in, and or encouraging their learners to really transform their own trajectories, you know, ambitious in quite a political sense for their learners to make the most of their lives and so on. So I think that's a kind of way of answering your question. So Donald Shearn, and then that was picked up very much in the 1980s in the UK and other parts of the Western world, was an important development at the time, but things can go further than that if you bring a more systematic approach to the inquiry and bring a more critical edge. And the Donaldson report that emerged did actually talk about teachers as leaders of change and in picking up that transformative teaching idea.
If we change gear a little bit now and go to the idea of teacher preparation, what kind of teacher preparation do future, I mean, let's leave it to primary for the moment anyway, primary teachers need?
As ever, they need to be able to cover a very broad curriculum, the way that primary schools are organised at the moment, and that is at the core of the historical concept of primary education. So it's a broad curriculum, it's a set of skills that enable them to work with a very diverse group of children, diverse in many dimensions, including social dimensions such as being sensitive to issues of ethnicity, gender, disability, to cognitive dimensions in terms of learning abilities, learning skills that children may bring, and in terms of behavioural dimensions as well. And you know, that's a whole lot of skills. But then, in addition to those, the curriculum knowledge and the teaching skills, I would argue they primary teachers need to understand something about the values of the work, values behind the work they're doing, and the purposes of primary education. So I do think that it was a great loss in primary teacher education when the so-called disciplines of education, including sociology and psychology, let alone history and philosophy, got marginalised and then more or less disappeared in most forms of teacher education, because certainly, to my mind, those provided the kind of intellectual rigour, a framework within which the skills they were learning could be deployed and exercised, and the curriculum they were working with could be developed and transformed into appropriate learning materials and experiences for the children. Is that part of an answer to
your
question?
No, that's,
I mean, nothing's changed in that respect, really. I mean, the only thing I think that has changed is that rates of change are getting faster, and that we can make use of digital technologies in some ways that can help to meet some of those challenges. But the world is an even more complex place than it was when I was working in primary schools. And so I think the challenges are much the same, but more so.
And I mean, given that you have been so active in teacher education, how do you think we can best assess a candidate's preparedness for a career in teaching?
It's still a great challenge, that, and there's a kind of commonplace assumption that people with good academic qualifications will be good teachers, and yet there's actually been virtually no research to demonstrate a link between those two. So there's a very challenging professional judgment to be made, and it's not always going to be the right judgment. And I think the kind of unfortunate answer to your question is probably you have to do your best to judge who's going to be successful, who's going to cut the mustard in primary teaching, but be ready for some failures and some non-successes, and be ready to acknowledge those when they happen, and to be able to support people out of the teacher education as well as into it, helping people to recognise that perhaps they haven't got the particular skills or capacity to develop the skills that they had hoped to have. It is a very, very challenging occupation, and not everybody can find a way into it successfully.
And given the stakes involved, you know, the impact that a teacher can have on children, yeah. It's incredible that we haven't got a better way, or that we haven't got better, yeah, at determining who is going to be good at this job, yeah, and who isn't.
I think we have got better, but we haven't cracked it. I mean, we've got more systematic, and the selection procedures are more rigorous, more careful than they used to be. The assessment of progress made by student teachers, beginning teachers, is more systematic. I mean, the standards that have been introduced into teacher education in all of the places we've been talking about have helped to provide some kind of baseline against which to judge teachers. They don't provide all the answers, but they do help to improve consistency in making judgments. So I think we have got better, but I don't think, I mean, and there have also been attempts to develop very sophisticated psychometric kind of tests to assess who make it, but they've had mixed success, I would say, to put it politely. And I think there's still going to be a lot of element of professional judgment in the end, and of talking with people. I mean, I said earlier about helping people out as well as helping people in, and you know, people do need to be supported when they're having a difficult time in teacher education.
Oh yeah, and I don't think it's just teaching either. I mean, I think, yeah, I read an article by Malcolm Gladwell where he was talking about how coaches in American football, uh-huh, pick out who is going to be a good American footballer, and that is a very difficult thing, yeah, to do as well. Like, even if you're a good college player, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be able to transfer into, yeah, the Super Bowl, you know.
No, I know. I think there's a lot going on in sport, actually, and in sports science, you know, the attempts to measure potential and the way that heartbeats and speeds and, I don't know, breathing rates are all kind of calculated or measured and then turned into some kind of formula for assessing who's going to be the best goal scorer, who's going to be the best defender. You know, they seem to have confidence in the sporting world that this is making some contribution. I doubt we'll ever get as sort of technically rigorous as that in education, and that's why I say I still think there'll be a lot of professional judgment involved, as there probably is in football or cricket or tennis.
What is your view on having common standards for teachers across a system?
Well, I can see the rationale for introducing sets of standards, because even if in the end it comes to a kind of professional judgment, a kind of community judgment about how effective somebody is as a teacher, what standards provide is some kind of language through which we can actually talk about teaching performance. What worries me is that if we only talk about the standards, we may miss some critical elements. You can't really measure creativity or flair or imagination You can mention them in standards, but you can't easily capture them when you're observing a particular teaching instant. You need to be able to talk with people, observe them over a period of time. So I think standards are, as I say, they provide some kind of base for assessment, but they're unlikely ever to be sufficient in judging how promising or how much progress a beginning teacher is making.
You began your career as a primary school teacher. Why did you choose primary teaching at the time?
I kind of fell into it, I'm afraid to say, when suddenly having failed at engineering, mechanical engineering, quite emphatically I failed at mechanical engineering. I spent a year trying to work out what to do, and it suddenly occurred to me, even though I'd kind of sworn I'd never go near a school again, I actually started developing an interest in children and their learning, and thought it would be fascinating to work with young children. So I trained as in those days it was an infant junior course, so I was prepared to teach from the infants through, 5 to 11, I think was the age range it covered. And certainly the experiences I had in schools during my initial teacher education did confirm that this was a really interesting and challenging and intellectually quite demanding profession. And that's not always recognised, I don't think. But actually trying to connect with young children so that they learn is actually an intellectual challenge as well as a kind of emotional and personal one. And that wasn't always recognised by even the tutors I had at my college when I was training, who thought I ought to be working with older children because I seemed to have some intellectual ability, and I really resented that idea. I think I still believe the youngest children need the most capable teachers. I'm not saying I was the most capable, but I do think it's a simplistic and wrong idea to think that the more academically able teachers should be working with the older children. So I had 11 or 12 years working in primary schools and found it very challenging, but really enjoyed it.
And how did you make the transition then to being a teacher educator?
Well, I look back on that and I found that I was starting to get a little frustrated, not at what was going on in the classroom so much as the culture of primary schools in that era. We're talking about the 1970s now and 1980s, was one which didn't take professional development very seriously, certainly didn't take research and inquiry seriously, and I found myself wanting more, wanting to understand what I was doing more. And so when an opportunity to get involved in preparing other teachers came up, I was tempted by it and managed to get a job as a lecturer in early years education at a college in Cheltenham. And that was the beginning of my career in higher education, and continued to kind of have lots of contact with schools through the teacher education work, but never worked full time in a school again, always in universities or colleges.
We're coming near the end, Ian, so I have a few general questions I'd like to ask you. And the first one is, what are schools for, or what is school for?
Yeah, well, this is a question that's been debated at the conference we're at in Tokyo. What are schools for? At one level, they are to prepare, to help young people make the transition from childhood to adulthood. And in the words that were used by one of our keynote speakers yesterday, they are there to provide time of freedom from home, but also freedom from the economy, a time to actually become who you might be, which sounds very grand, but actually that is the kind of historical function of schools, as well as being actually part of the economic system and preparing people for employment or unemployment or whatever. It is to help children develop a sense of who they are and who they might want to be. So I think that's the kind of organic, optimistic view of what schools are for. they're not always seen as, that's not always how they're seen in wider society, and they are seen as, shall I be a bit coarse and say, sometimes they're seen as exam factories, testing factories, which are there to sort children rather than to develop them and liberate them. And of course there is the way education is developed, in certainly in the Western world, is that they do have a sorting function. And in the past, in England, you used to do your first sort at the age of 11, and then another sort at the age of 15 or 16, and then a third one after that. Those kinds of processes still happen, less so at the age of 11 perhaps, but the idea, the significance of GCSEs and A-levels still remains a very important part of schooling. But, you know, that there will continue to be, whilst we need schools to recognise the economic circumstances that they're working in, the employment opportunities, the skills that will be needed in our economy in the years ahead, they will have that function as well. And it's a legitimate function. It's just that we shouldn't forget the full range of responsibilities of schools. Personally, I think we still do need schools and we still need teachers, because the transition from childhood to adulthood is not a straightforward one in a society as complex as ours. And I think the more we can make those make them humane institutions that provide opportunities for open opportunities for learning and for young people to really think where they want to go in their futures, the better.
Is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
Funnily enough, there are one or two that stick in my mind. One was a geography teacher in my secondary school who used to really try and get us out of school as much as possible in field trips and so on. And even when we were in school, we were kind of modelling things in tanks of sand and water and so on. And I think he's probably one of the most inspiring teachers for me. But he wasn't a particularly nice person or whatever. It's just that he was deeply committed to his subject and wanted us to learn it. And that seems to me the most important thing. So I think he's the teacher that I remember best.
Who or what inspires you?
Now, who or what inspires me? Well, my colleagues inspire me. I mean, I think working in teacher education, we have a great professional community, and that's very inspiring. I'm inspired by some particular colleagues over the years, been supported by some particular colleagues. I'm not inspired by contemporary politics, I have to say, other than by the kind of rise of certain movements such as Extinction Rebellion or the movements against global capitalism a few years ago. There are social movements that can be quite inspiring, but kind of conventional politics, I am very depressed by what is happening in the UK at the moment with Brexit. I think it's a bad error on our part to have voted for it by a small margin. I'm worried about what's happening in the USA, so that's what I'm not inspired by. But what gives me hope are really the young people who seem to be getting organised to try and make sure they have a planet in the future where my generation have probably failed in that respect, which is very sad.
Have you a favourite book or blog or writer about education?
I've recently been preparing a lecture to remember one of my former colleagues who died last year, Jeff Whitty, who was the director of the Institute of Education in London, died far too young last year. And I mean, he was inspirational for me, but in preparing my lecture in memory of him, one of the sources I've gone back to is the American sociologist C. Wright Mills, who Jeff introduced me to actually when I was doing a master's with him. And what C. Wright Mills captured was the connection between the personal and the public the kind of relationship between public and structural problems in society and personal experience. And it's a kind of key idea in his book, The Sociological Imagination. And although he's not an educationist, he's a sociologist, or was a sociologist. I do find that inspirational. If we're limiting it to educationists, then probably the greatest inspiration for me was Paulo Freire and his ideas about transformational education, and he's inspired a lot of people. And his first books that were translated into English came out just as I was training to be a teacher in the 1970s, but I continue to be inspired by his writing about education for liberation, education for democracy. So he's probably been one of the biggest influences on me.
And finally, Ian, what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your practice in education today?
I think I probably learned more about what not to do than what to do. And I mean, I wasn't particularly happy at secondary school. It was a very traditional school I went to. Primary school, I got inspired by the kind of non-curricular things. I talked earlier about field trips and so on in secondary school, which were the best part of secondary school, and camps and things like that. But in primary school, I developed a real obsession with bird watching through one of the teachers in the primary school. And, you know, I'm telling you about things that were not part of the formal school provision that inspired me much more than... So I do think schooling needs to be exciting in some way. It needs to connect with children. And there was an awful lot that didn't connect with me or with my friends in primary and secondary school. I think we've learned a lot about what not to do, and I hope we'll learn and provide more that is liberating, exciting and developmental in what lies ahead.
And that wish for education to be liberating, exciting and developmental was expressed by Ian Mentor, Professor Emeritus at the University of Oxford, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. To listen back to this programme or any of the hundreds of previous podcasts, please go to seandelaney.com and click on the Podcasts tab. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review of it on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps more people find out about it. Write to me with feedback or suggestions to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from online bookstores and many local libraries. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.